Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy and I are engaging in friendly sauce wars today. And some of the question is, what are the sauces we care about? But also, when to sauce, when not to sauce, why would you, what's the history of it? So give everyone a quick primer on the classical French sauces. Do you think of sauces, do you think of France first?
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a million cynical things to say about.
Okay.
And I love French cooking, but I have a million cynical things to say about the overdoing it of French sauces.
So the five mother sauces or grand sauces, and what that means is,
and these are via,
you have a foundation,
Escoffier, right?
Right. This is from Escoffier. So basically, in the 19th century, you had Carême. Sort of beginning to define what is classic French cooking. Carême was a prolific cookbook writer. He wrote more than pretty much anybody else. And so through that documentation...
His cookbooks are amazing. They look more like French fashion designs.
His drawings and drawings and everything. It's really, yeah. They're beautiful books. But so he really began to define the mother sauces. And so you have, and Hollandaise is later added. Carême considered four sauces to be the mother sauces, which is Espagnol, Velouté, Bechamel, tomato, and then adding Hollandaise. And so other sauces come from these base sauces, why they're called mother sauces.
So
they're the foundation sauce.
So the basics of the mother sauces. Just run people through.
Right. Espagnol is a veal stock reduction, or it's a veal stock reduced down with roux, again, so butter and flour used as a thickening agent, a little bit of tomato product, carrot, celery, and onion added to it, bay leaf, a little bit of black peppercorn. And once this is reduced down, it is originally Espagnol, and later it becomes demi-glace. Demi-glace is means half glaze or half sauce, meaning that you've taken that original Espagnol sauce and brought it down even further. One of the aspects of working with a sauce that has a roux in it is you have to skim the sauce. It throws off fat molecules, and those need to be removed as it comes to the top of the sauce. So you always kind of, in that reduction process, you want to have your saucepan a little bit offset off the burner so that it throws that sort of scum or whatever off to the side.
Meaning
of the
not
bottom.
Directly on the fire, so it's hotter on one side than the other,
mm-hmm.
so that scum is attracted to one side.
Right. A velouté is a very simple sauce. By the way, that Espagnol sauce would be strained. None of those ingredients would be left in. Going to velouté, a velouté is any stock thickened with a roux. So now you have fish stock thickened with a roux, lobster stock thickened with a roux, could be chicken stock, veal, beef stock, anything thickened with a roux. And just for an example of what a sauce from that or a sauce that grows from the mother sauce, one of the more simple versions would be to add cream, and that becomes a sauce suprême, meaning a more fine sauce. So you would have a velouté finished with cream, and then you have a suprême sauce. One of the other sauces is bechamel, and bechamel is a very simple sauce made with milk, which makes it very affordable and very easy to use. So you have milk, you would take a piece of onion, and you would actually burn a big slice of onion. We would do it on a flat top in a restaurant if you had one, but you could do it in a hot, very hot, dry sauté pan. Stick that sort of little bit burned on one side slice of onion with a clove and put that in with your milk, a little bit of salt. They would always use white pepper. Personally, I would use black pepper. I don't like the flavor of white pepper, and I'm not concerned about there being those little flecks in. And then you thicken that with a roux. That is a bechamel sauce. And a sauce that a lot of people are familiar with is Mornay. And Mornay is a sauce that comes from bechamel with the addition of Parmesan cheese and Gruyere added at the end. So this is kind of helping you to understand these sauces that form from the mother sauces.
In our gluten-free world, those first three...
Oh,
are off the menu because they're all thickened with the roux.
Well, yeah, and tomato also has. I mean, traditionally, the next mother sauce is tomato, and it's made so very differently in French cooking from, say, in Italian cooking, because it is simply carrot and onion sautéed in butter, adding a little bit of flour to that pan, adding fat back to that pan, so you're going to have some pork product in there, rendering and. Then adding tomato product to it, tomato puree, and again, a little bit of aromatics, bay leaf, thyme, peppercorn, and then you're making that sauce, and that gets strained. So it's a very unusual form of tomato sauce, one that people are not used to.
So let's take, we have a couple of calls. Let's jump to calls real quick. I'd like to go to the to number two, Dina, who has
Hello,
a sauce question.
Dina.
Hi, Dina.
How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. I'm glad you're speaking about sauces today.
Good.
And as far as the debate goes, perhaps because I haven't delved too much into making sauces, I'm one who thinks less sauce is better.
Oh, no,
when
you're...
it comes to vegetables,
Dina,
I want the vegetable taste to come through. And the only sauces
Dina,
I have seen with
vote.
Vegetables are just a thick butter sauce.
Mm-hmm.
So what could I do as a sauce with vegetables that is not just swimming in butter?
No, I would. That's where Tony's extra virgin olive oil comes in.
What's a vegetable that's coming up that you're excited about?
Well, you know, I think when it comes to, I know I had a southern mother-in-law who said Marylanders don't know how to season green beans. Those I like just plain. Mm-hmm. But now things like squash, if you had a lot of butternut squash or things like that, I think would do well with some kind of a sauce, a light sauce.
I would say, honestly, butternut squash, for example, is a very easy thing to have and to roast in maybe like a 350 oven, nicely seasoned, rub that with extra virgin olive oil, maybe a little bit of crushed garlic, and tuck a little bit of the garlic underneath the sort of the open bell. You know, you want to have the shell part of the squash up and let that garlic steam under there a little bit. Salt it nicely, salt it for a little while and leave it out at room temperature before you put it in the oven.
Put
it in that 350 oven until it begins to almost kind of wilt a little bit. Let it cool in its shell. Scrape all of that out, and what you end up with is a nice puree. And you could finish that puree with a little bit more extra virgin olive oil or with a little bit of simple capers and lemon, and you have something very light that has good flavor.
I love that. Mm-hmm. Simple, is always the best. Don't make things too complicated.
But you have to buy a great squash, and you have to cook it with care,
right.
And you have to season it thoughtfully. And the little steps about seasoning it and leaving it out at temperature a little bit after you split it, that's kind of a big deal.
That's the whole thing with simple cooking, is the original product has to be excellent, and then you have to execute it correctly.
And it takes attention. And then we have a call from Craig in Bel Air. Craig, go ahead.
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Craig.
Great.
Hi. I just wanted to get a little advice, and I'm sorry my question is not about sauces.
It's okay.
But my wife and I are going to go to France in May, and we're going to spend a week in Burgundy.
That's great. It's the world headquarters of sauces.
In Pommard, right outside of Beaune, and then another week in Vaison-la-Romaine in northern Provence.
Oh,
you got good spots.
I love Vaison-la-Romaine.
You said in May?
Oh, that's awesome.
In May, yeah.
That's going to be
a spectacular, especially big time spring in Vaison-la-Romaine at that time.
We're really looking forward to the markets and the food and the wine, and that's why we're going. But I wanted to ask you guys, since you've been over there so many times, What is one thing that we absolutely have to do when we are there?
I want to give you one in Beaune, and Cindy's going to give you one because she loves Vaison-la-Romaine. Okay? Why don't you go ahead, Cindy, with Vaison-la-Romaine?
In Vaison-la-Romaine, there is a chef, and I would say he's probably in his early 80s now. He and his wife have a beautiful little restaurant that has a terrace, and it's on the river. And it's as you begin to walk up into the ancient city, the Roman city, it's on the left. And I hope that the terrace will be open. It's called Moulin, M-O-U-L-I-N, a huile. So it's H-U-I-L-L-E.
Moulin huile d'olive, yeah. The mill of the olive oil.
Yeah, it used to be a mill where they made olive oil. And the chef, he is actually doing some modern cooking there. But some of his food is really, really amazing. And oftentimes when you're on the terrace, you can actually see him. He kind of works in this little kitchen off the back of the building, and you can actually see him kind of working in there. And his wife is really beautiful, and they have a great wine list, and it's a real treat to go there. I would absolutely go there.
Oh, well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
In Beaune, which is a very short drive from Pommard, in which is a marvelous city to walk all over the place in, there's a small restaurant off the Place Carnot, and they have a very limited schedule, so you have to try to get on their books early on. It's a restaurant called Ma Cuisine. It's literally my kitchen, and it's a couple, Fabrice, the woman is the chef, mm-hmm. and Pierre, her husband, is the maître d'hôtel, sommelier. And it literally kind of looks like somebody's kitchen.
Yeah, it's a very tiny restaurant.
It's not rustic. I mean, literally like someone's kitchen, like in maybe 25 seats or something like that.
At the most, yeah.
Maybe 30. The cellar is stocked with all kinds of goodies. Pierre knows his stuff. He has a, besides all the
Get
wines
the
from Burgundy, the pigeon that she does is amazing.
Oh, so good.
If there's a tureen of foie gras and sweetbreads on, that's amazing. And there is a burnt almond tart that exists so that Pierre can show off his collection of great Sauternes, which are not from Burgundy but are really fun to drink. Mm-hmm. And that's a remarkable visit there.
Just a little bistro
and
there.
Super unpretentious place.
Do you remember the name of the bistro? There's a little bistro there.
The one on the square?
Yeah, that we often go to that's good, too. I can't think of the name of it. We'll have to...
The little steak tartare spot. Yeah. I have to think about it for a second.
All right.
So, well, thanks for the call very much, Craig.
Thank you. Have a good trip.
So we're live and taking your calls, obviously. 410-662-8780 or toll-free 866-661-9309 or email us if you're a shy person. ForemanWolf@wypr.org. So Cindy, you ran through the mother sauces of French cuisine. Is there some other sauce or some other cuisine that has something that you think is missing entirely in that? Or what do you think the big development or change has been as food has become more global? What is the effect, you think, on French cuisine that you've seen?
There's been a big effect on French cuisine. You know, again, if we go back in time a little bit and you have, you know, Escoffier kind of absolutely defining classic cuisine through his cookbook, which is called Le Guide, which, I mean, when I went to culinary school, that was written in the late 1800s and has been rewritten in the early 1900s. He was one of the greatest chefs of that time. And for him to basically write a Bible defining what classic cuisine was, this really defined French cooking during that time because all the chefs had to make things exactly the way it was written, basically, between Carême and Escoffier. So there was
in
no,
the French
you know, like
classifiers.
The thing is that if you went to a French restaurant at that time as a guest, even if you went to visit Escoffier when he was at the Ritz in London, they would expect his Hollandaise sauce to be exactly the way it would be made in Paris by another chef. So this is a very interesting part of cooking at that time, is that chefs, there was no creativity allowed. And this is a big change. You ask me what is the change, that's part of the big change.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I think there's a lot of quality from the classification that came through that time in French cooking.
Well, that's it. It builds discipline to have that in your repertoire.
But there's also missed opportunity.
Well, of course,
because the eggs
are
totally different.
But the opportunities have come.
If you're in a restaurant in
England,
you're having Hollandaise, you know,
maybe Escoffier didn't have the opportunity, or the other chefs at that time. But as time has come on, then you had the advent of Nouvelle Cuisine. Again, Fernand Point was the beginning chef there, you know, in the 40s and 50s. His restaurant was open and near Lyon. And
his cooking was super interesting because it was an intersection point between that classical discipline cooking, the cooking of his region, the traditional like grandma food, you know, and his own creativity. And you swirl those three things together with someone who is confident enough to do it and pull it off.
And that's new cooking.
And everybody kind of came, everyone in France that changed food after that came out of that kitchen because of his mindset.
Paul Bocuse worked for him. The Troicot brothers, I can't remember which one worked for them, him. So yeah, I mean, he was extremely influential. Now you have this idea that, yes, we are cooking regionally. Yes, we can change things. Yes, we can lighten things. So you have this huge change from the Middle Ages where food was so dense and overly spiced to this food that becomes lighter, less, and people stopped using roux even. So that was another big change. They were going to natural reduction sauces. And that's another, along with wonderful local regional
products.
It's
the next step after demi-glace.
Yeah.
Let's go to a few more calls. We've got Jude in Baltimore. Jude, go ahead.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks
How
you for
doing?
Taking. Not good. I'm in bed with a cold, so if you can't understand me, let me know.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
I'm the world's
Get
worst
better.
Cook, but thank you. I'm also gluten intolerant. I'm not fashionably. This is under doctor's orders. What could you substitute in a roux that would have the elasticity of wheat flour
Nothing.
And rice flour?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Okay.
Sorry.
But for me, you help make the case that you... that you don't need to have a root thickened sauce.
You don't
in order to have an excellent dish.
Certainly not. Yeah. So you can just
I kind of missed that part.
Sure, and that's understandable. And you're not alone. A lot of people can't have wheat products. So, you know, you're just doing a natural reduction, or you can thicken with butter, or you can thicken with egg yolks. Just have to be very careful when you do liaison, because that happens at the end of the cooking process.
Is there a dish that you have in mind, or something that you want to cook that you wish for a sauce for?
Just a basic root that I used for years to start sauces.
Mm-hmm.
But reduction, you know, that's fine. Butter's good. I can eat butter.
There you go.
Butter's very good.
Things are looking up.
You learn, there's a million YouTube videos, learn to make the world's best. If you can make hollandaise well, then there are a million different alterations. If you want to have there like one fancy sauce under your belt that you can dress a piece of fish or dress a piece of meat with, and be classical about it. That's one to do.
Well, and there is a substitute for roux too, which is arrowroot. In the 80s, that was a big, when I went to school, we used a lot of arrowroot instead of roux in our sauces. So you could always do that.
That's out of those Swiss guys.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jude.
Thank you so
we hope
much.
You feel better, Jude.
So let's go to Virginia in Baltimore, who has got a question.
Hi, Virginia.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Great.
Thank you.
How are you?
Good. Listen, I wait all winter for shad roe to appear, and I just cook it for myself because my husband doesn't eat it. But I don't like a lot of sauce on it, but I do like just a little lemon butter kind of thing. But I never really know how to make it.
How do you
a nice viscosity?
How do you cook your shad roe?
Well, because I am also gluten intolerant, I literally, sometimes I'll dust it with a gluten-free powder or flour of some kind. But usually I just saute it with a little butter and olive oil.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think if you took the time to clarify butter and you saute it in that in a very heavy pan and control the temperature well, you're going to get a nice coloring on the whole thing. Don't cook it too hard. Let it rest a little bit. I mean, brown butter is a great thing for...
Yeah. Yeah,
for a garnish.
When
for
you talk about consistency of a brown butter, there is no consistency possibilities. It's simply what it is. You can't do anything to change that. So what I would do is I would make my brown butter in a separate pan. The shad roe pan is going to get pretty much, I'll just use the word, annihilated.
Yep.
I'm sure it gets very dark and brown by the time the roe is done. And also, as we both know, if that skin is pierced, some of the roe will come out. You know, you have that whole popping fun sensation. I'm sure you have a lid.
Yeah.
On the pan. Yeah, it's sort of like going to battle cooking shad roe.
That's why that heavy pan and controlling that heat carefully so you have your best shot at controlling that.
Yeah, I would just brown the butter in a separate pan, and right at the last moment when it's right at the temperature or the color that you like it to be, add your fresh lemon juice to it, and then on to the fish it goes.
I tell you, if you can find or you like caper berries that you find quartered, rinse them well and add a little bit of that as your garnish is pretty
caper
fun.
Berries
for
are great. Or capers.
Darn fun for
shad roe.
Yeah,
it would be
a
good garnish.
The texture is nice with
a little parsley, a little chive. That would make it pretty and aromatic.
Thanks so much.
Enjoy.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks so much. We'll be back in a few more moments with more calls and questions on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine on WYPR.